Welcome back to the Policy Viz podcast. I'm your host, John Schwabish. Welcome back to the show, everyone. I'm really excited for this week's guest, Alyssa Fowers, who is a PhD student at the University of Miami, where she studies research methods, applied statistics, and data visualization with our good friend, Alberto Cairo. Alyssa and I sat down at the Tapestry Conference back in December to talk about her interests in school and her work in the research methods department and in the communications department, and talk about how she visually communicates both large and small numbers, and her blog, Data and Dragons, which I've been really enjoying over the last few months. Just a couple of quick announcements before I get to the interview. The first thing, if you are interested in getting some free books, go check out a blog post I wrote a few weeks ago. I've linked to it in the episode notes. I'm giving away some extra books I found in my office while I was cleaning out some bookshelves. I have a couple extra copies of Cole Nussbaumer Naflick's book, Storytelling with Data. I have an extra copy of Andy Kirk's book, extra copy of The Big Book of Dashboards, extra copy of John Tukey's book. So if you want to try to win one of those free books, go over to the blog post that I've linked to in the show notes and see what you need to do to win those books. It's been a couple of months. I'm just going to keep extending that contest until we reach the threshold that I can start mailing those books around the world. Second announcement is, again, another blog post I wrote a couple weeks ago on data visualization inventors, founders, and developers. I've been doing some writing lately about different types of graphs, and I got to thinking about who are the people who created and invented and developed some of the graphs that we use all the time, not just the line graphs and the pie charts and the area charts, but you know, who created the Venn diagram, for example, that has a capital V in it, or who created the first Sankey diagram or the Gantt chart. So I wrote a blog post and opened up a Google sheet where I'm asking people to put in some names and links and original articles from people who they think may be the original inventor or creator of some of our favorite data visualization that we use day to day. So that blog post is also linked on the show notes page. So go on over there and check it out and see if you can contribute to this open project. And maybe we can have a nice catalog of people who invented some of our favorite graphs. So anyway, on this week's show, I'm really excited to chat with Alyssa Fowers. And here is that interview.
So do you want to start by talking a little bit about your background and how you got to the University of Miami?
Sure. So I sort of arrived through a circuitous route, which I think a lot of people do. There's a lot of I got into this by falling backwards through a door and sliding into a new dimension. Seems to be the common story.
Yeah, common thread. Yeah.
Yeah. So my undergraduate degree is actually in social psychology.
Okay.
And I was a little bit of a lab rat. I did a lot of research, which meant I had data, which meant I had to analyze it. I actually applied to and was accepted into and was considering going to some PhD programs in social psychology research. I was studying implicit bias. And what wound up happening was that I realized that what had me leaping out of bed at 2 in the morning and running across campus was not that I had a new idea about how implicit bias worked.
Mm-hmm.
It was that I had a new idea about a potential interaction effect in my data.
Right.
So that got me thinking that maybe I wanted to work in data and analysis, maybe more than I wanted to.
So you were really more like excited about working in getting your hands dirty in the data.
I just wanted to see what was going on.
Yeah.
I like exploring. I like making things.
Right.
So I decided to sort of lean into that curiosity.
Right.
So from there, I actually graduated, moved to Washington, D.C., and worked in a mix of data analysis, management, a little bit of teaching, a little bit of database design for about 5 years. So I worked for a consulting company, as many people who graduate and move to DC do.
Yeah.
And then I worked for a nonprofit as sort of their, my title was data manager. Anything that could wind up in a graph was my job.
Okay.
So a very wide range of things. And what I realized sort of two things. One was that people kept coming up to me and asking me questions about, you know, is this legitimate? Can I say this? How far can we push this? What does this mean? You know, is this a real difference? And I wound up saying, I don't know,
mm-hmm.
a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing was that when I gave people data, people treated it as the hard and fast truth.
Mm.
So it was this, I think Mona talked about this a little bit earlier, the terror of your word being gospel,
mm-hmm.
And not really having those checks and balances. And I realized that I just didn't know enough to do the job that I was doing in a responsible way. So thinking about going back to graduate school, and actually, as fate would have it, saw Alberto Cairo speak at a conference I was at for work, and thought, "What if I did that also?"
Yeah, right.
Let's
interrupt real quick. The people at the nonprofit who were coming to you, those are like senior researchers.
I wouldn't say there was a research team, but would be like the CEO would come to me and
say, "Okay."
Yeah.
And so they didn't have like a data background. Okay.
They were very smart, very analytic people who did their own analysis and would go into the data and do stuff and say, wait, can I actually do this?
Right.
That kind of thing.
And so they were asking you to double check, fact check, mm-hmm. but asking more, sounds like asking more of the harder analytical questions.
Yeah. And we worked with a research company at one point where they did a little bit more an in-depth analysis for us. Mm-hmm. And I wound up doing a lot of the like translation back and forth and that kind of work also.
Gotcha. Okay. So you're doing the data analytics stuff. Mm-hmm. You're doing some of the viz work. Mm-hmm. You're doing the communication bridging sort of thing that's amorphous that everyone's trying to figure out. And then you come down here to Miami. Mm-hmm. But you're not in the communication department.
No. Right. I studied in the program of research, measurement, and evaluation in the School of Education. So that's research methods, that's some applied statistics. So it's both finding things out and then thinking really hard about how we find things
out.
And I wanted to add in that third piece, which was telling people about mm-hmm. the things that we found out, which seems like a very natural fit to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And so just quickly on how the program works. So you have, I would guess, your core part of the program in the School of Ed, and mm-hmm. then you also have classes in the School of Communication?
So I have classes in the School of Ed, and then I have elective slots that I use in the School of Communication.
Okay. And then, so the reason that I wanted to chat with you is because you wrote one particular post that, mm-hmm. that caught my eye, but also sort of a back series mm-hmm. about getting people to connect mm-hmm. with data. Mm-hmm. Do you want to maybe walk people through the core argument that you're making here?
Sure. Yeah. So the blog post is called Time and Space. It's on my blog, Data and Dragons. The core of the argument is that the space that is spent on figures in a chart, the time that is spent in sort of scrolling through something that's interactive and digital, is also a form of encoding, that we use these things to communicate priorities as well as communicating just straight information.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I have some examples in the blog post where there's just a blank page.
Right.
So I think it's like the Wall Street CEOs from the Great Recession.
From the Recession, right.
And it's just a blank page. And so if you think about what the New York Times can put on a page in print, it's an enormous quantity mm-hmm. of information. And to them, having this blank page, having that shock value of they're nobody, there's nothing, was as important as everything else that they could have put on that page.
Mm-hmm.
There are some other examples too, where it's sort of the opposite, where rather than having a lot of blank space, you take something and you give it a lot of space. So, there is part of the post that includes a visualization about, the victims of the Las Vegas shooting. And what that does is it takes, I think it's three numbers, and it expands that into an individual image of each person. Mm-hmm. So you could say that in three numbers. It's very, very small. People injured, people shot, people killed. That could be a single sentence. It could be a very, very tiny table. And instead, what they've done is they have sort of blown that up into an individual outline, a sort of silhouette for each person. Mm-hmm. And it's not like the kind of thing that you often see where there's a single very uniform like bathroom sign person.
Or like a bar chart or like, mm-hmm. Yeah.
It looks like people are milling around talking to each other like they would have been just before the massacre. So I think that's giving space to each of those individual people and making them into people again to an extent.
It's also interesting because you talked about there's sort of two parts here. Mm-hmm. So there's the print part mm-hmm. and then there's the digital part.
Right.
So I want to come to the digital part because mm-hmm. you had made an interesting comment how our perception, I guess, of the story mm-hmm. is in some ways driven by the order in which things are shown.
Right.
In the print side, when it comes to the CEO example you talked about mm-hmm. earlier is a good one, right? So we're looking at it here. But like, it's basically, it just says in the Times, I think this is, like mm-hmm. 10, the CEOs of Wall Street sent to jail. Mm-hmm. And it's just a blank page. Now, that seems to work, from my perspective, that works in print. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it would work on the website.
Mm.
Only because there's like, there's stuff on the top and yeah. there's stuff off to the side and then there's ads popping up. And so yeah. I wonder if you've thought about like this distinction between mm-hmm. this approach, print versus online.
Yeah, I think that's where the sort of the timepiece comes in mm-hmm. in the title. So this particular example where it's a blank sheet might not work, but there was one, another gun violence post that was extremely striking to me. I believe it was also in the New York Times. It's a graphic of legislation, gun control legislation yeah. that's been passed over, I believe, between the Sandy Hook shooting and the Parkland shooting. And if it's a series of tiny calendars, and each day is shown in gray. It's month by month. There's the number of mass shootings above each one. There's little notes about like what might have been mm-hmm. legislation. And I just remember scrolling, and it's all blank.
Right.
Every single day is gray because right. nothing was ever passed.
Yeah.
And so it's this really remarkable experience because you keep expecting something to happen
yeah.
and nothing happens.
Right.
And it's sort of violating the expectation that you have of this calendar. And it really, you know, it's one thing to say no gun control legislation was actually passed or very minor gun control legislation was actually passed. And another thing to just see where something should be mm-hmm. and have nothing be there at all.
Right.
So you're sort of taking the viewer's time to communicate an absence.
Right. Yeah, I guess it is also true that there are pieces like there's this piece from the Washington Post mm-hmm. where it's the maps of segregation, which is mm-hmm. sort of now famous. But like it is its own thing. It's like a black background and mm-hmm. there are no ads. So I guess yeah. there are ways in which they do mm-hmm. that.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
There was actually another sort of scrolling effect from that post about the Las Vegas massacre or the article about the Las Vegas massacre. There was an online version of it as well. And they didn't just reproduce the same graphic, which was part of what was so striking about it to me.
Mm.
When you scroll through, at some point, you get to where I think this graphic was in the print version, and the screen just goes white.
Mm-hmm.
And then a sentence pops up that says, here's the number of people that were injured. And you just keep scrolling. Here's the number of people that were, you know. So it forces you to sort of sit with each of those ideas while you're scrolling.
Right.
Because there's this really, really compelling personal narrative going on either side. To see what happened, you have to put your attention on
yeah.
these things.
Yeah, right. It takes your attention, and then you have to you're forced to wait.
Right.
For the next piece.
Yeah.
As opposed to that bar chart where it's like, oh, there's three bars.
Right. And that's what I think is so striking to me about it, because in print, the limitation is really, I believe it's space.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas online, the limit is really attention.
Mm.
You have potentially unlimited space.
Right.
You can make your website or your article or your post or whatever as big as you want, but you're really limited by how long people want to look at it.
Yeah.
And so it sort of comes back to that thing about values and priorities, where whoever was designing that visualization, or that scrolling experience decided that it was worth potentially losing people.
Yeah.
It was worth spending the time on it because this is very important.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a lot of what was very powerful
yeah.
to me about it.
Have you thought about the change in direction, as it were? So mm-hmm. most of these, you know, these sort of scrolly kind of mm-hmm. things are all vertical.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to have a lot of steppers that were horizontal.
Mm-hmm.
And there only seems to be like the rare occasion where they're kind of blended. Like I mm-hmm. remember The Guardian did this story mm-hmm. on the Mekong River a few years ago now, probably, where at least in the mobile version, it was a combination of you would scroll mm-hmm. down and then you could scroll across and then mm-hmm. it would bring you back. I don't want to put you in the spot. Like, have you come across any of those projects or just generally the differences in direction in that way?
Hmm.
And maybe it's something that's just different between a mobile platform mm-hmm. and a desktop or a laptop where, mm-hmm. especially if you don't have a
yeah.
touch screen, it's just a different interaction, right?
Yeah. I think that part of my guess would be that the move towards having things be vertical scrolling is because people are looking at things on mobile. From my own experience working with spreadsheets, I don't
yeah.
like going sideways.
Right.
So I have an instinctive desire to not go sideways.
Yeah.
If something is stepping across a screen and I don't have to actually scroll to see it.
Where it's a physical step.
Yeah,
or the chapter, the page turn. Yeah,
it's less aversive to me than having to scroll right forever, because I'm just like, oh my God, why isn't this in a database?
Yeah.
Why isn't this in a long format? Which lets you know how my brain works a little bit. I think also that I'm going to take back what I said. There is a little bit of more space limitation when you look side to side.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just because of how people are used to consuming information digitally. If you're reading a document, you're scrolling down.
Yeah,
not scrolling,
not scrolling
across.
Side, right.
Unless, like you said, you're in like an e-reader or something where you have this vision of turning pages.
But a map, for example, like I mean, we obviously look north-south, but also east-west. Mm-hmm. And so if the story was to go from west to east, like the Washington Post did that story on the eclipse, and I'm trying to remember how they set it up. I think it was its own sort of thing, but I don't remember it going like where it was showing the path of the eclipse across the country. But I don't remember like swiping or something like left and right. And so
my guess, if I remember it, is that you zoom.
You zoom.
Yeah,
right?
It's not like you have to go in a specific order.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so that's sort of an aside, because that's interesting. But I want to get back to this this idea of using the silhouettes of the people. Mm-hmm. Because in this particular example of the Vegas shooting, it's silhouettes of people. It's not dots. It's not bars. Yeah. It's people.
Yeah.
And so I guess that's just a broader question about using icons in data visualization and your thoughts on how that helps the reader or hinders the reader, and how it's useful for data visualization creators, and also potentially a challenge for creators.
I think that an icon communicates a lot. And one of the things that is really interesting to me about icons is how important the level of detail is. So in this Las Vegas massacre image, they're clearly people. They're sort of leaning. They're grouping in kind of organic ways. So they're very clearly people, but it's really hard to tell what gender they might be. They're you can't tell what race anybody is. You really can't tell anything about them except that they're probably all adult people. So there are sort of different levels of detail that communicate different things. So like I mentioned, the sort of bathroom sign. Icon, all that says is person. You know, it's pretty generic. It's instantly recognizable. People aren't going to spend a lot of time looking at it and going, "What is this?" Or absorbing the details. But as soon as you put more detail into that, the more specific you make an image, the more specifically people are going to read it.
Yeah.
So if you take that sort of generic human outline and you make it more gendered, or you make it into a child or something like that, people are going to assume that what you're showing is sort of relevant to everything included in your visualization. And as you sort of add more detail, the message that you're sending gets more and more specific, because you can get, of course, all the way down to a photograph of someone.
Right.
But then it's extremely specifically that person.
Yeah, that person, yeah.
So I think that it's something to be aware of, where the less detail you have, the faster it is to process, but the less specific it's going to be, and the less sort of immediate resonance it's going to have with the people who are looking at it. So
that the gender icons, for example, like the bathroom icons, there's like basically the icon, which we all sort of recognize now as male, only because I think the female icon, the sort of standard one, has like a triangle dress sort of thing, right? And so that directs us in the two directions, but we also have like gender is a spectrum. And so that adds an additional, and race is, people can have various backgrounds. So like, you know, how are we as designers, or maybe better question actually, as you, as a designer, like communicating this, like, how do you start thinking about this? I mean, I don't think there's a right answer, an answer to this really, but you're clearly thinking about it. So I'm curious, you know, if someone were to bring a graph to you and to say, you know, I've got, you know, income for men and income for women, and I want to use icons, like, how do you start thinking about the limitations of that? And
So I think that in a case where you really have this categorical information in your data and it's really important to the analysis, it makes sense to show it as these two categories. But I think it's also important to recognize and acknowledge that you are going to have non-binary people in a lot of data sets, and that not all women look a certain way, not all men look a certain way, not all non-binary people look a certain way. And I don't, you know, I don't have a great answer for how do we have imagery that is instantly recognizable, that appreciates that gender is not necessarily this hard and fast binary. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really important to keep it in mind and to just be mindful about what you're doing while you're doing this work. And if there are non-binary people in your data set, don't forget about them. If they're there, make sure they're sort of visible.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult, right? Because mm-hmm. they're certainly, almost certainly are non-binary mm-hmm. people in a lot of the data sets we mm-hmm. use. But they're either, you know, for whatever reason, they're not identified.
Yeah.
And so I think the general message, right, mm-hmm. is to just be aware, or yeah, try to yeah. be aware, mm-hmm. which is what your implicit bias works. Like, it all comes back, right? Like, try to be aware of these things, mm-hmm. even though it doesn't show up in the data necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Right.
As an explicit tag.
Yeah, yeah. So I should probably clarify a little bit. I do mean that one should always be aware of it, but if in your data set you have this explicit tag, I do sometimes see people saying, well, we have non-binary people in this data set, but it's like 1% of the data, so we're just going to exclude them from everything.
Right.
Yes,
yeah.
Right. So that's the kind of thing that is important to me to not just like leave out or exclude. And yeah, that question of how do we do iconography when we don't have discrete groups is really hard.
Yeah, really hard. Yeah.
It's really hard. I don't have a perfect answer for it.
Can you tell us a little bit about your research? So you've got this interesting mix, which is like, it's like the, you know, I don't know, it's like the Renaissance person. I don't know, like it's like, seems like it's the evaluation side, but also then sort of the communications and database side. So can you talk a little bit about, I mean, a PhD is a long thing, so I'm not, you know, so what is your research about, and how are you blending all this together?
So right now I'm working with my advisor, Dr. Sun on a second order meta-analysis, which is an abstraction of an abstraction, basically. So a meta-analysis is a synthesis of lots of different effect sizes about the same phenomenon synthesized into one. So it's sort of averaging across a bunch of different studies to say, we have looked at a lot of research about this issue. If we combine everything together, here is our estimate of how big this is. Or how big, you know, what this relationship is. So first order meta-analysis, which is what most people think of, is summarizing primary research. So you have an individual study, and then where you compare one group of people to another group of people, and then you get a bunch of those, and that's a first order meta-analysis. Mm-hmm. I'm studying second order meta-analysis at the moment, which is you're doing a meta-analysis of meta-analyses.
Gotcha. So you have 100 studies, 100 point estimates of some relationship between X and Y, and 10 people have done meta-analyses of those 100 studies, and so you are doing the meta-analysis of the 10 studies.
Yes.
Okay. In a particular area?
So I'm studying it from a methodological perspective.
Okay.
So right now what I'm doing is a simulation study. So it's all, I make up data to study an abstraction of an abstraction.
Right,
it's just the most academia thing I think I've ever said. I go through all that to say that this has been a case study in how hard it is to talk to people about statistics.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Where, you know, I'm trying to write a grant application or something, an article about this, and it takes 8 words just to say the 2 things that I'm talking about, and people's eyes close at the third word.
Yeah.
So that's some of the research on the statistics side that I'm doing. I have an interest, though, sort of more generally in this translation piece.
Mm-hmm.
I think that data can seem like a foreign country full of incredibly perfect hard truths that if you throw a lot of money at trying to get at it, you can come back with an ironclad path of action that will undoubtedly result in success. You can come back with pure hard truth. And having worked with data in a lot of different ways, sort of having my hands in databases, seeing how it's collected, seeing how it's analyzed, that's not how it works.
Yeah, right.
Data is intensely human. And so to me, being able to communicate, being able to sort of accurately communicate what the data is actually saying, being able to translate it for people is immensely important.
So you've got this methodological piece of your mm-hmm. work here mm-hmm. that is doing this second order meta-analysis. But really at the core of what you, it sounds like what the core of what you really drives you in some ways is trying to take these 100 estimates and trying to communicate that to people, even though there's various levels of uncertainty and distributions around within each study and then within, you know, across all these studies. So is the sort of bottom line goal, I guess, to try to figure out a way to communicate relationships between variable A and variable B to policymakers and stakeholders and decision makers? Is that like what's where you're trying to get to?
I'm going to give you, again, the most academic answer possible, which is...
Well, I'm glad we're sitting at the university now. We should have done this, like, at a coffee shop. I would have gotten, like, more...
right. So that is... that's one of the things that I really want to do, and that's very important to me. I think that with my work here at the university, I'm very much a both-and person. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to... help people do this research in sort of the best way possible, while also having this, being able to communicate it out. I am also really interested in applied problems, in sort of getting into more actual data and doing analysis on stuff that actually sort of comes from people and is applicable to sort of more hands-on situations. I do think that part of doing a good analysis is being able to tell people about it. Because if you do the most brilliant and cutting and insightful analysis in the world and nobody knows what you're talking about, it's the tree falling in the forest.
Absolutely.
Thing, right?
Absolutely.
If your analysis falls in a desk drawer, did you ever really do it?
Absolutely. Hallelujah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So for me, it's this combination of wanting to make sure that data is handled in a responsible way, and also making sure that it's understood. Mm-hmm. And these things very much go hand in hand for me. And what's also very important, and I'm glad you mentioned it, is making sure that it's understood by the people who are going to use it. Mm-hmm. Not just having other academics or other visualization people understand what I'm doing, but making it a more open to people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is one of the really big challenges, I think. And as someone who really likes making things and experimenting and sort of throwing things at the wall and seeing what sticks and falling, you know, not falling, leaping down rabbit holes, it can be hard to sort of reel it back to what actually makes sense to other people.
Yeah. I think you've cut out a pretty big slice of the graduate work pie. So Well, Alyssa, this is great. Thanks. And good luck
on all this.
And I'll put the posts on the show notes so people can check them out, and I'll put some pictures on the site. Mm-hmm. So great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
So thanks so much for listening to this week's episode. I hope you learned a lot. I really do hope you'll check out Alyssa's blog, Data and Dragons. She's writing about some really interesting things and some interesting observations, especially at the crossroads of data visualization and research methods and statistics. So please do check out the show notes. There's some good resources there, some old blog posts, and some other things that I think you'll find interesting. So until next time, this has been the Policy of This podcast. Thanks so much for listening.